Sherazade, I just read and talked to John Barth a little while ago.
His book
was, The Last Voyage of Somebody the Sailor.
Somebody the Sailor. Exactly, yeah.
Did you have a chance to read it?
Yeah, I actually published the opening pages of that book in the issue of Conjunctions that came before the music issue.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. Long-standing John Barth fan. Actually, Barth had never appeared in Conjunctions before, so...
Well,
if I can lean into this thing, how close do you want me to get to him?
Just about right.
Roughly there.
Well, he's certainly a challenging read.
Yeah.
His novel had a little bit of everything that Barth is known to have done in it, though.
Right.
It had echoes of his very early stuff. I think The End of the Road and the Floating Opera.
I'm so fond of that. I understand his obsession with Scheherazade and so forth. I wonder what would have happened had he not got so involved with the retelling of, you know, those older stories and so forth. And if he had kept on the road of the floating opera, and I wonder there's so much there and what a career that's been.
Well, I think for Barth, he wanted new challenges, mm-hmm. and he wasn't content with, as he would put it, just telling a story.
Right,
he wanted
right.
more than that. So right. The Last Voyage of Somebody the Sailor had all sorts of tricks and games mm-hmm. in it mm-hmm. that you could spot, and obsession with things like time and clocks and on and on and on. But you're right, I love those early books. In fact, when I was a kid, I had bought them in paperback, and I still have them. I've been carrying around these paperback versions of those first two novels for years, and I still have them, incredibly. And it's also incredible that his first novel, Floating Opera, was published in something like an edition of 2000. So if you're able to come across a first edition of it, should have some merit.
It has a very beautiful dust jacket on it. I think I own a copy, in fact, of that first edition. Very beautiful, published by Appleton and Crofts?
Yes.
Publisher that's long since gone its separate way.
I understand that book was remaindered for a dime.
Oh, it's amazing the books that have Watership Down by Richard Adams mm-hmm. Was published by an obscure publisher in England in a very tiny edition. I can't even think of the name of the publisher. Turned down everywhere in the United States. Basically rejected by all publishers in England, and finally wound up with this, I wish I could remember the name of this publisher, and done in an edition, I think, of fewer than 2,000, more like 1,000. If you can find one of those now, it's worth more than 1,000.
Well, I have an American edition of that. I interviewed him on the occasion of Joseph Campbell's birthday. He came over for a banquet for Campbell, and so we had a chance to talk, but I had an American edition of it, mm-hmm. which probably doesn't have very much value, but has value to me, because uh-huh. I've been a book lover since I was a kid. Well, let's talk about you, and we can talk about other authors, mm-hmm. but we're here really to celebrate you and your work and your new book, Almanac Branch. Before we get into it, maybe you can just shed some light on your literary origin, so we know what led up to this book and how you became a writer.
Well, I have no literary origins.
You have none?
None to speak of. I didn't really read a book all the way through until I was in my late teens, I guess, maybe 17, 16, 17, I'd start books. The family was composed primarily I'm from Colorado, and it was prairie farmers from Nebraska and so forth. And pioneer mountain doctors, not Mercedes-Benz type doctors, but doctors who would work in coal mines, you know, for coal miners and up in Steamboat Springs and small towns around there. And growing up in Colorado, we had a set of Dickens on the family mantle, but no one really touched it. It was more there as a objet d'art or something. Lots of National Geographics around, and I think there was an edition of Emerson Modern Library, but it's not a distinct... I come from no literary background. Occasionally people will say, are you related to William Morrow of you know, William Morrow Company, the publishers, and I say, indeed, event, I suppose, in some place way back in time, perhaps, but, no, my literary experience began when I fell ill of colitis in Italy. I was a foreign exchange student, the American Field Service, and I had been to Honduras the year before because I wanted to be a doctor myself in the sort of family tradition, and a couple of months in Honduras convinced me that I wouldn't be cut out for that. And when I was recuperating from this illness, I happened to be lucky enough to be with a family that had an extensive library of American and English classics, and I simply went through them book by book right across the shelf, in not in alphabetical order because I'm not that orderly a person, but just as dust jackets would attract me, or as spines or titles, or I didn't know what I was doing. And then went back to the University of Colorado, wound up getting a Danforth Fellowship to Yale, wound up studying under J. Hillis Miller and all of the emerging structuralist critics at Yale in the early 70s. Moved to California, peripatetic life, actually, and befriended Kenneth Rexroth, the poet and translator and polymath. And it was Kenneth who, above all, I suppose, brought me to another level of reading and interest in literature. He had a 16,000 volume library around which I wandered and plucked and read and so forth. And I suppose that would be my literary background. It's an eccentric one. It's not your standard growing up with the novelist father, or, you know, a critic for a father, or any kind of library in the family. It was a very simple childhood, really.
So you would say that Kenneth Rexroth was your literary mentor? Or is that an exaggeration?
It's fair to say. We argued like cats and dogs, because I had my own ideas by then of what I liked, and had already read a lot of Ezra Pound, Wyndham Lewis, and a number of American modernists and British modernist writers who... And then I would follow their leads, their books of essays and so forth. If Pound would say, you should read Dostoevsky, I'd go read Dostoevsky. If he would say, go look at the sculptures of Henri Gaudier-Brzeska, then I would go check those sculptures out. And so I tended to follow leads of... Well, Pound was actually alive then. I never met Ezra Pound. But I would follow the leads of bookish, in other words, inside books mentors before I met Kenneth. But we had a lovely, very close, he was 50 years older than I, so I guess grandfather to son, but it felt like brother-to-brother relationship. We talked on the phone a lot, and he tried to convince me to become a poet rather than a novelist. So that there began a lot of our scraps. It was all an astounding kind of one-on-one post-postgraduate, informal and idiosyncratic kind of education.
Well, having this rather eccentric literary education and becoming attached to books and authors and the idea of words and literature doesn't necessarily pay the rent.
That's true.
So what financed your interest and love for the literature?
Well, I was a musician, a professional musician for many years, and made my living as a studio musician. I would play in various kinds of bands, jazz bands. I would do scab work, I'm sad to admit, in the middle of the night for non-union scale on various commercials that I won't name names. It was, again, that was also a peripatetic lifestyle.
You played what instrument?
Well, I played pretty much anything, but I was very good at guitar. I was primarily guitar and piano. I studied piano as a child for years and years and years, and still can play. I hurt my fingers in an accident, and that is what really moved me away from music. I had to kind of make a decision at some point what kind of art, what way of expressing myself I might be able to to adopt for myself. And this accident, in a way, decided it for me because I couldn't play for 6 or 8 months. And the fingers lost their elasticity in a way. You know, I can still play, and I still own far, far more guitars than I should own, and far better guitars than I deserve to own. But I worked in a rare bookstore for a while. I've dealt with, you know, book selling. I worked as a book restoration person for a while. I ghost wrote a couple of MA theses. I've worked at any number of jobs you can think of.
Somewhere along the line, Conjunctions was born. How did that happen?
Well, that was at the very end of my stay in California. I had gone out to Santa Barbara to work on a book at Black Sparrow Press, and Rex Roth was at the end of his life, and I'd kind of stayed in Santa Barbara to be with him and sort of near him. And he and I hatched the idea of doing a festschrift for James Laughlin, who's the publisher of New Directions. Again, when you self-educate, when you're self-educated, you owe people who are different than your professors, since they weren't necessarily around. You owe people like publishers and their visions, or certain writers. And Laughlin's New Directions had a profound impact on me. If I saw a New Directions book, I knew that it would be an interesting thing to read as a rule. Of course, it's not always right, but Rex Roth and I sent out some letters to about 70 writers saying we wanted to do a festschrift in honor of Laughlin's achievement with New Directions. And somehow more letters came back than had gone out, and the first issue of Conjunctions was kind of born. Kenneth then suffered a stroke and couldn't go on with me. And I was pretty fascinated by a number of manuscripts that very interesting writers had sent just to show me, out of kindness or curiosity or however that worked, and I kind of fell backwards into Conjunctions too. I funded the first 3 issues myself, and pure ignorance of how these things don't work. Literary magazines just don't make money. You can stay up any 300 nights in a row with your pencil and paper and work it out that it's going to work out, and it simply doesn't. Then there was a private publisher for a couple of issues, and then David Godine, the Boston publisher, picked up Conjunctions and published us for a number of years there. By that time, I'd moved to New York. I've been here for 10 years, which is exactly the length of time the magazine's been coming out. Collier Books did it for a while at Macmillan. And now we're published by Bard College and distributed by Random House, which is a very happy conjunction of publisher, distributor, and so forth.
Now you have to publish Leon Botstein.
Right.
Whether you like it or not.
Actually, Leon's piece of the new issue is a very interesting piece of work. I don't think he expects to be published by Conjunctions, but it's not that. I have complete editorial independence, and I have had it contractually through all the publishing arrangements we've made. We've had, again, peripatetic seems to be the word. We've had quite a torturous, I think is how one person phrased it, but we've had quite an existence here. You know, literary magazines have historically had a hard time of it staying afloat, and we're certainly no exception. I guess we've had maybe 5 publishers in 10 years. But each of those publishers has been very good about editorial autonomy and so forth. They can be grumpy about what I've run, and in fact dump me or dump the whole enterprise, but they've never stopped the magazine from coming out. They've always honored their agreement with the journal.
Do you now have some sort of role on the faculty at Bard?
Yes, I'm a Bard Center Fellow. I teach one creative reading course, I call it. I'm not too interested in teaching creative writing. I never studied creative writing myself, and I'm sure it works for a number of fledgling writers to go through a creative writing program. It works for some people. It would not have worked for me personally, and therefore in a way, I've taught a couple of creative writing seminars and so forth. Maybe learning how to edit yourself or something like that. But I teach a course up there on contemporary literature, contemporary novel, the contemporary short story. I'm going to teach a course this fall on the new Gothic, new forms of Gothic expression in contemporary fiction. So they let me.
I hope you'll focus on James Purdy a bit. He's one of our most neglected writers.
Purdy is so spectacular a writer and really one of the great American Gothicists.
I go over and see him. He lives literally in a garret.
Yeah, I've visited him there.
Have you been up to about the fourth floor of this
walk-up? Over in Brooklyn.
Yeah, Brooklyn Heights. Sometimes I go over and take him out for lunch. He's had some problems with his eyes lately.
Purdy has always been a writer who I felt has deserved a much wider audience. He writes a very riveting and quite readable book. He's one of the writers I feel who has both broken new ground formally, a very innovative writer, and at the same time he's quite traditional even, and in the Southern kind of tradition of writing a yarn, a good, you know, Gothic-like yarn.
Black Sparrow is about to come out with his complete short stories. And he sent me a note last week saying that his novel, which has not yet found a publisher here, is about to be published in London, where most of his books were first published, in fact. Well, let's get back to you. Your first novel, Come Sunday, set in Honduras, and that is certainly no coincidence. Tell me about this book. This was published, I think, in 88, right?
88, yes, by Weidenfeld and Nicholson.
The lamented Weidenfeld and Nicholson.
The ill-fated Weidenfeld and Nicholson.
Well, they're still around, kind of, with a Grove identity now.
With the Grove Weidenfeld, who seem actually to be doing pretty well, from what I can understand. It was a good experiment, Weidenfeld and Nicholson. I wish it had worked for them.
That was Purdy's publisher for,
exactly,
I think, two books.
Oh, well, Purdy and Robert Stone and David Levitt, and I think, and I'm going to, Edna O'Brien, I believe.
Right.
Many, many fine writers they had brought in, and I was one of their, I think it was the longest first novel that they had published. And, well, Come Sunday, it took me about 4.5 years to write, maybe 5 years, as opposed to about 6 months on the Almanac branch. It's rather extraordinarily different experiences as a writer. And it's fairly multinational. It's not just Honduras, but, you know, Nicaragua, Italy, France, the Midwest, New York City. It's multilingual. It's multifaceted. It's multi-voiced. Many narrators actually in the central section of the book take over and tell their different stories. And it was a very very ambitious and very dark book in a way, a book with a lot of political commentary, and the Almanac branch. Actually, Come Sunday, in a way, was at least two novels, someone remarked. I think it might have been as many as three novels in one. It's a maximalist book, as Paul Westwood would put it. It was unafraid of using a lot of language, and for all its length, it's actually a fairly concentrated book, too. There's a lot of stories that are told there, tall tales and wild tales, and it's basically a book about the death of Europe in America was one of the ideas, about the notion of discovery and how Europe, you know, moved through the centuries into America, and how America must find its own way back out of the holes it's digging for itself, out of, you know, historically European, traditionally European ideals and interests. So it's a book that deals with economics and evil. The two E's.
Well, the Almanac branch is certainly different, because it's about the family and the family's disillusion, and the people within the family, who the protagonist, of course, is a young girl who grows up to be in her 30s by the time we finish reading the book. What gave you the idea for the Almanac branch? You probably hate questions like, what gave you the idea for this book?
But what's this book about? I don't know. If I could tell you that, I wouldn't have had to write it. Come Sunday in its own superficially larger pattern is also about family. I can't imagine writing anything that isn't in some way about how the individual responds to family, whether family be a larger family of say, a corporation or an immediate blood family or a family of a tribe. I'm reading Chinua Achebe, the Nigerian novelist right now, and I'm noting how close he and I are in many ways in our observations about family. He's dealing with pre-colonialist tribal family in a lot of cases and how that's affected by colonialism. And the Almanac branch came out of many desires, but for one, a desire to deal at a more personal, intimate, immediate level with the family and how the individual in a family, in this case, Grace Brush, as you say, the young female narrator of the book, how she uses her imagination and how uses her imagination to find her way both into her family and out of her family. She's grown up in a family, a very dominant, very powerful, and I suppose there isn't a person alive who isn't eccentric in his own or her own way, but these are definitely eccentric people also, individual people with their own agendas and their own ways of being. And what I really wanted to see was how Grace knows things. She is sort of the center of this family she has the power of the family in that she has all the information of the various branches of the family. They come to her in their own individual ways. She holds their secrets, and so she is powerful, and yet she feels, as do each of the other members of the family, that she's powerless. And so there's a kind of, I was very interested in how families balance each, individuals and families balance each other off, and how the dynamics of a family can work when a family member, such as her father, gets themselves into fairly serious trouble, or they're moving into a period of crisis and potentially disastrous jeopardy, which is Charles Brush. Her father is a entrepreneur. I'm always very interested in business also in both novels. He's an entrepreneur who's about to he's been doing something which we won't necessarily reveal, that is about to jeopardize pretty much 30 years of his career. And his son is involved with this too, although the two of them don't really know the other's participation in bringing ruin on the family. And Grace knows all this. And so she really, the Almanac branch is about all the men in her family. She's projecting both into the future, such as an almanac does, by recording the past, just like an almanac, you know, works. So she's recording kind of the weather, the spiritual weather of where the family can go, where she can go, how she can fit in.
Grace has migraine headaches, which manifest themselves in very stark visions. Tell me about this. This is not unusual, I understand, from reading about migraine sufferers.
Oliver Sacks wrote a wonderful book called Migraine, which deals with migrainous auras and so forth. It's amazing. When I give readings from the Almanac branch, I have yet to give a reading when someone doesn't come up afterwards and say, you've described exactly what used to happen to me or what still happens to me. I think the migraine, in a way, it's funny how words work. You can say, I've got a migraine today, and a word can get watered down to where it finally has very little meaning anymore. Whereas a migraine is actually really a very serious disease. There's no cure for it. There's no good medical evidence about how it works. And it's a very historically widespread disease. At its extreme, migraines can produce psychotic ecstasies, visions, auras. I did some work up at Mount Sinai in the library there and did a lot of research with people I knew who suffered from extreme migrainous situations, including a young friend of mine named Karen Kelly, who's been a lifelong sufferer of this disorder. She does not suffer, I will say, for the benefit of her family and friends, anything near what Grace goes through. But migraines can actually change what you visually see. Your face will not be there. The idea that you even have a face can sometimes be punched out. It's called the donut effect in medical terms or in medical jargonese. Your hair can turn into icicles. You can, all kinds of things can happen. And I was initially reading about memory disorders. I was interested in memory and how it functions as a part of the imagination, how we, you know, I'll remember this experience of talking with you today. I'll try to remember the table and the green wall and so forth, your tie and everything, but it's bound to be altered by my imagination, really within moments of leaving here. It's probably being altered by my imagination even as I'm talking to you. And I was interested in that, how memory and imagination function together. And it seemed to me that migraines kind of step it up an extra notch. Because you were isolated by a migraine, the pain of it, you're backed into your imagination only. And really, you spend a lot of time with yourself when you're suffering from one of these attacks. And the imagination pretty much takes over. St. Hildegard apparently suffered from migraines, and this accounts for a lot of her visions of the city of God and angels and actually many mystical visions and religious visions and so forth could possibly be accounted for by this very widespread and quite misunderstood disease.
Now, I want to ask you about Grace's sexuality. There are a couple of, there's one particular erotic scene in which Grace makes love to the ghost of her brother who was killed in a fall. But it struck me as interesting about Grace's sexuality in that she seemed to, all through her life, she seemed to accept it in a very low-key manner. Mm-hmm. Even in the scene in which the young Asian man has sex with her and ties her to a bed, she seems to enjoy it, but she also seems to just accept it without any deep sense of feeling or am I wrong about this? She seems to accept sex in a very low-key way.
Well, she has some pretty high-key sex for.
I don't deny that.
And also, don't forget that the encounter with the brother is utterly manufactured by her imagination and her longing. It's not a.
But she did have an incestuous relationship with her brother.
Well,
in a childish way.
Well, they did not have sex. They couldn't have. They were far too young. If we want to get specific about it, I think, you know, there was no way for him to enter her. I mean, they really did not have incest as such. They played around as kids do, and I think Grace probably reacted to it loving her brother, feeling isolated on Shelter Island, because the book is set on three different islands, Manhattan Island, Shelter Island, and St. Bart's Island. So it's a book of quite a lot about isolation. And yes, I think Grace feels isolated. I think that's why she pushes it so hard sometimes sexually. I think that's why she pushed herself into the one short marriage that she had, and she pushed herself into this one affair that she had. In a way, she sampled the every possible sexual cliche relationship that a New York or any, actually, it doesn't matter whether you're in New York or not, that a woman or a man can, in fact, have. And I think she samples this because she realized, or she pushes herself into these situations because she does sense that she's isolated, and she wants to find a way out of that isolation. And don't forget that her relationship to men in general with them, this very strong and yet absent father, because her father is always on the road with his business, very strong and yet absent brother, because Desmond is no longer around after a certain point, a very strong and yet absent other brother, Berg, who in fact is kind of a nemesis to her, I think. In a way, she loves him, but I don't think he loves her back. I don't mean sexual love. I mean as brotherly love and sisterly love.
That's the next question I wanted to ask you about Berg, actually, mm-hmm. right? It has two names. And his obsession with making the movie, which recounts, I guess, what he fantasizes his sister's relationship was with Desmond. Tell me about that.
His name is Burke, and his nickname is Berg, which is, of course, I suppose, some tie to Bergman, although I hadn't realized that when I wrote it. His fingers are very chilly, so he got this nickname when he was a kid. Also, he's chilly, I think, a bit of a chilly fellow. He may have a warm heart, but if the blood doesn't get all the way out to the extremities, is, I suppose, the idea there. In a way, Grace took over. You know, you asked me a question about Grace's sexuality, and in a way, it was such an amazing experience to write this book. I was in control very much as an author who knows his craft, theoretically, and knows as much as he can know at a certain point in his life as a writer. But Grace, there was an inevitability to what Grace's experience would be, and I just want to make sure that that's kind of understood, that I suppose when I got to a certain point in the book, and Berg's recapitulation of the novel in the shape of sort of Manet masterpiece art film would throw the entire almanac that Grace had constructed into question. We would look at again at Grace's life from another distorted angle, and again that's imagination at work, and how imagination and memory, it's Berg's memory of how they had grown up together, and basically it would be another way, I suppose, thinking about it as a novelist, I saw it as another way to shed yet more light on Grace from another family member who we by then would know fairly well and not trust, any more than we should trust Grace or trust Bradford Morrow or trust anyone's reading of any given life, whether it be in a novel or outside a novel. So the film recapitulation or redoing of what Grace's life had been, which is done in a kind of quick way toward the end of the book, was a kind of way, it was sculptural, actually. It was a way of taking this portrait and turning it a bit to the side, like pulling it from another angle, and looking at it once more in a different light, so that we as readers can see it from yet our own vantage, a third, we can triangulate the experience, as it were, and make up our own minds what's happened in this family, who this woman is, what her experience has been, and conjecture what perhaps would happen to her in the future outside of the book.
Bradford, is it difficult for you as a writer to balance your own career and goals as a literary man with the task of being an editor and having to deal with other people's work? I mean, you have two stacks of papers on either hand, I would think. How do you reconcile that?
People ask me, how do I reconcile that? And I honestly...
I'm not the first person to ask you?
Well, we'll see. Yes, of course you are, Don. I've never heard that question before. I suppose the way I reconcile it is when I feel... I'm not the kind of writer who gets up and writes 3 hours every day from 7:35 to 10:35 and then walks for 15 minutes and then has a cup of tea and then goes back for an hour and a half and then has lunch and then goes, there are historically writers who, many of them, who have an absolute program for their day. That doesn't seem to be part of my makeup just as an individual. My novel writing is primary to me and is first and foremost. And really, in a way, Conjunctions is a wonderful way of when I have downtime, when I'm not working well, when I'm not working at all, when I'm taking notes, when I'm building a book internally, Conjunctions is a spectacular activity for me to see what everyone else is doing, talk with them. I suppose I'm a literary man, amazingly enough. But when a book comes out, then everything goes, everything else is, I'm afraid, is pushed to the back. I'm hatching a book right now, and it's really like, it's very much like dough in an oven rising. I don't map out a book, a novel, any more than I map out an issue of Conjunctions while I'm doing it. I'm working on the 10th anniversary issue right now, and I don't have a clue what it's going to be like. And it really is. It's going to be published on November 15th, theoretically, and it will be. So in a way, Conjunctions, I treat it almost as if they were books, novels, as it were. Someone had mentioned... Alice Quinn of The New Yorker and I were on a panel together up at Brown University earlier this year. And Alice had mentioned how Marion Moore, when she was working as a poetry editor at, I think, the Dial magazine back in the 30s, she thought, Marion Moore felt that every issue that came out under her editorship was like a poem in and of itself. And we've forgotten this, but there's a long tradition of novelists and writers also editing literary magazines. Ford Madox Ford did for years. T.S. Eliot edited a magazine for years. Pound had edited at least a couple. Wyndham Lewis edited three, I think, different literary magazines. I don't think there are very few authors in the early part of the 20th century who didn't at one point or another have some deep involvement with literary magazines.
It must be very time-consuming, though, reading the unsolicited manuscripts plus what's being written today and published. And
well, I'm an insomniac, so... yeah, it's hard work, and I will keep it all up as long as I have the energy to do that.
Where do you work on Conjunctions?
I work out of my apartment here in New York.
And when you get everything together, then do you... Then what happens?
What I do is it's very much done...
Lays it out, I guess, is what I'm asking.
Well, that's done in Maine. When I accept a manuscript, it goes straight away off to the typesetter, and it's not really assembled as a book and then delivered to the typesetter as such. It's always done week to week, so Conjunctions is ongoing at all times. For all I know, I'll go home this afternoon and there'll be something in the mail that's just exactly right for the new issue, and it will go, and it'll probably be typeset by the end of the week. The novel writing does take over when it starts to go, and Conjunctions, then I rely very much on my experience, because I've edited, I haven't counted the pages, but it has to be between 4,000 and 5,000 pages of published work at this point. It's quite a shelf because every issue...
In Conjunctions, you're talking about.
Yeah, I mean, for your listeners who haven't ever heard of Conjunctions or seen one, they're, you know, the new issue is almost 400 pages. The last issue is over 400 pages, and it's not a thin magazine of any sort. There really are books, and... In a way, I really kind of like the process of doing them in tandem. I don't really, one doesn't necessarily eradicate or necessarily even enhance the other.
I think that's why Gordon Lish does the quarterly. He was telling me that he's something like 2 years ahead. Mm-hmm. He's finished them.
See, I don't do that. That's a different style. I would not want to accept materials 2 years in advance, partly because I wouldn't want to keep writers waiting that long, but partly because I can't keep up with my own work, and I like it very fresh. I like materials to be accepted and then published within months of acceptance. That's what I like to have happen to my work, and so that's what I try to do with the magazine.
So, Bradford, your goals, I guess, to keep doing what you're doing, or do you have some special project in mind?
Well, I have a couple of novels that I'd like to do. One is tentatively called A Night Book. There's an anthology coming out with Random House this fall called The New Gothic, which is a collection of contemporary Gothic fiction. And this next novel that I'm doing would be fairly more in the Gothic, as I see it, the current Gothic tradition. Then there's a book after that that would be a much larger and more historical a novel. And I have ideas for a book of essays as well. And yes, as long as I can keep doing all this, I think I'll try.
Looks like you have a heavy agenda ahead. Well, Bradford Morrow, I appreciate your coming in. The Almanac Branch, a beautifully written book. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.